It's estimated that over 300,000 Kurds were murdered during the years of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. In her biography, Love in a Torn Land, Joanna al-Askari describes her battle to escape the brutality of the Ba'athist regime. The book is written by Jean Sasson, published by Wiley, and I'm very pleased it has brought both Joanna al-Askari and Jean Sasson to my show today. Hello.
Hi. Good to be here.
And Jean, you've been here before.
Yes.
Are you specializing in books about the lives of Middle Eastern women?
Absolutely. I'm a people person. I love these women. I lived in the Middle East a long time, and their stories worth telling, and I keep stumbling into these very interesting women with interesting stories.
Well, where did you first hear of Joanna's story?
I heard about her about 2.5 years ago from one of my other heroines, Miata, and daughter of Iraq, who's a very good friend. And Miata said, oh, you've got to talk to this woman. She's a distant cousin of Miata, actually. And she was almost killed during the chemical attacks in Kurdistan in northern Iraq. She escaped barely. It was a thriller, really, and a beautiful love story, which I've never had the opportunity to tell anything about a love story before. So that was nice.
The majority of the interviews were carried out over the telephone.
That's
where
right.
were each of you? Where were you?
I
Joanna.
Was in England and obviously talking to Jean in America.
Yeah.
And we met.
Yes.
Several
we
times
met a
as
couple
well.
Of times, and yes. I would call her every day for 2 years, and we talked 2 or 3 hours each day
yes.
because Joanna had what we call post traumatic syndrome.
Yes,
and
right.
she would have a tendency when I'd ask it a direct question, she would sort of freeze up and sometimes hang up the phone on me.
Well, that's not unusual. People who've gone through really rough times
that's
generally
true.
Don't want to talk about it.
That's true.
Would you have talked about it with anybody
no.
if Jean hadn't been persistent?
No, never thought about it. Actually, I was. When I met Jean, I was more interested to meet Jean Sasson because I have read her books and I was really excited to meet her. And then when she told me that she's really interested in my story, I was really nervous because I never talked about my experience before. And it was really like a therapy for me in the end, I think it turned out...
Mm-hmm. Well, your husband went through many of these terrible experiences with
That's
you.
Right.
So did that create a different dynamic because you didn't have to say, oh, gee, or you could talk to him in a way that you might not be able to talk to somebody else?
Well, because he was, excuse me, he was before me. I mean, he was a fighter 5 years before me, and we used to talk about all these things, what happened to him before I joined him. But later on, I mean, we went through a lot of attacks from the Iraqi government and especially the chemical attack. It was really difficult because after that, we were on the run, really, and we couldn't talk about it, you know, like that way between us. It was just like something in the back of our mind, and we had to flee, and we went through a lot of bad time after that.
Well, you grew up in Baghdad.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And we see news reports every day
yeah.
from Baghdad. Does it look like the city you grew up in?
No. No, it's totally changed. And it's very sad.
Now, well. you're the daughter of an Arab Iraqi father and a Kurdish mother,
yes.
but you're described as a Kurd. Is that by your choice?
Well, yes, it is, because I don't know, I have this, I more belong to the Kurdish part of my family, let's say.
You were brought up that way?
It was my mother's influence, because... we used to spend all our time in the north, in Kurdistan, and I spent my best, happiest time through my childhood in Kurdistan. And I have really that bond, very strong bond with Kurdistan.
When you were young, Ahmad al-Bakir was the president of Iraq
yes.
before Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
Were his policies any nicer toward the Kurdish population
no.
than Saddam's?
No, it wasn't. It never been. I mean, if you look at the history of the Kurdish people, they were treated badly throughout the regimes who took power in Iraq. And it's just different, way of treatment, yeah. but it was all
bad. A lot of people had to remember even Winston Churchill ordered chemicals yes. to be dropped on the Kurds.
I always wondered yeah. why Saladin, probably the greatest hero of the early Muslim history, I mean, after the mm-hmm. Muhammad and that mm-hmm. whole story, he was a Kurd.
Yep.
And he solidified Arab thinking at the time.
He was a very wise ruler. Yes.
So how'd the Kurds come to be so reviled?
I think it's just throughout the history, as I said, they were treated very badly.
Because they are different. They have a different culture, different language, different history. They have different loyalties. Mm-hmm. And I think that really aggravated all the leaders in the area.
But we, in a country like Iraq, you have three groups yes. that each have mm-hmm. different histories, different loyalties, mm-hmm. because you have the Sunnis and yeah. the Shiites. Mm-hmm. The Sunnis controlled the country, even though they were a minority. Did the Shiites and Kurds ever try to effect some kind of alliance to protect themselves?
Well, the Kurds had their own struggle in the north. I mean, we always been, you know, under attacks from the Iraqi government, and we always were maybe the first people who stood against Saddam, and in the south as well. I mean, they tried, and because because of the geography of our country.
That's what I was going to say. Yes. I think you were separated, you yes. know, one's in the north, one's in the south, so they sort of made their last stand in those areas.
We had places yeah. to hide in the mountains, yeah. but unfortunately for the Shias in the south, they just had the marshes, and it was all destroyed by Saddam, so it was really difficult for the Shia to struggle, to keep, you know, the fight, you know. But in the north, with all this mountain area, and the Kurds are very, you know, familiar with yeah. their territory.
They say flatten the mountains and the Kurds won't last a yeah. day.
But the Kurds also can't find respite in any of Iraq's neighbors, Iran, Turkey, Syria. They all have had they've all persecuted the
yes.
Kurds
yes.
over
yes.
the years.
Yes, unfortunately, that's why it makes it very difficult to have a solution for the Kurds.
It's very difficult. And if we look, Joanna, and if we think about it, from the very beginning, the Kurds were promised after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, they were promised their own nation. Yeah. There were a huge population. They didn't get it. They were sort of divided up. So it created tensions in each one of these countries with the Kurds.
Yeah.
And the Kurds are, if nothing else, stubborn.
Yes.
They never, ever stop their struggle. Nothing ever discourages them from fighting.
That's true.
Which is still a matter in Iraqi politics
Definitely.
Today. Gene Sasson's written a book called Love in a Torn Land. It is published by Wiley. And it is the story of the woman she calls Joanna of Kurdistan.
Yes.
Is this a new name for you, Joanna?
I love it. I'm proud to be called Joanna of Kurdistan.
This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you say you self-identified as a Kurd. Did that affect you when you were growing up? For example, were you discriminated against in school or in the neighborhood you were growing up in?
Yes. But in the same time, I mean, I was born in Baghdad, grew up there, went to school and university there. But throughout my childhood, we were discriminated against, and we had several, you know, problems with the government. And my brother and my brother-in-law were imprisoned just simply because they were Kurds. And also at school, I used to be teased, you know, the Kurds and the Kurdish girl. Or, you know, at university, we would have people who would always put pressure on us to join the Ba'ath Party, which is you have to, it's a must. But somehow I managed not to get involved with that party.
And you said you made many trips to the north to the Kurdish part of the country. Mm-hmm. You've said that Saddam's policies amounted to genocide. Did you feel safe during your visits to Kurdistan?
Through my childhood, no, because every time when we go there, although, I mean, it's in Iraq, but we never got the real picture about the struggle and what's really going on in Kurdistan. So we, when we go there, then we would hear all these horrible stories about people get executed. They arrested Peshmerga, whom they are the freedom fighters coming down to the city. They just arrested them, taking them. Their families got harassed. It was really terrible.
I was amazed some of the stories you told me, like which I put in the book. Like if a Kurd owned a pair of binoculars, mm-hmm. it was a death sentence. Yeah. Imagine that. So they were very, very careful guarding the Kurds, and no one could be like a freedom fighter. I mean, you had to hide to be a freedom fighter. Yeah.
Well, a freedom fighter meant that you were also a secessionist, mm-hmm. and I would see the Ba'ath Party, even if they liked Kurds, mm-hmm. being opposed to a breakup of the country. It's still mm-hmm. an issue in the country. One of the most brutal of all of the acts of the Saddam government was the massacre on Martyrs Hill. Oof. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, I wasn't even born then, but I always told that story about these people who were arrested, normal, innocent people were arrested and taken to that hill, and they all buried them, and you just see their heads upon the ground, and people were stunned because they didn't know what's going on. And it was really a brutal thing to have a shovel coming and just...
A tank run
over the heads of those innocent young people just
all
because they were
men.
Kurds. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Jean, why do you think this is such an underreported story, the plight of the Kurds, for quite a long
time in Turkey, in Iran. I think it's political.
In Iraq.
And even our own government, you know, when the genocide occurred in 1987 and 88, our own government, you know, even Reagan came out and said that the Iranians did it, not Saddam's. So that was a big scandal, and there was such a hue and cry about that until he backed down. I think it's political. No one really wanted to stick their neck out for the Kurds. You had the different instances when the Shah of Iran used to be for the Kurds, and then he made a deal, and, you know, Henry Kissinger got involved, and so then they forgot the Kurds again. So the Kurds were never really important enough. That people would take up for them against any of the nation states they were living in. So I think it was purely political. They were just a forgotten people, and it was a silent Holocaust.
Joanna, did your siblings share the same passion for the Kurdish cause that you did?
I'm sure they were, because to marry a freedom fighter and join him in the mountains, that was, you know, the ultimate, because they would know that I'm going, I might not see them again.
Your family blessed the marriage?
Yeah, absolutely.
How did the marriage occur? Because so many marriages in the Middle East are arranged. Was this an arranged marriage?
Well, we had like a family connections with my husband's family, but my marriage was one of the unusual ones.
Love.
Yes. So he was obviously with the opposition party in the mountains, and he could not come down to the city. So I had to go and join him. And it was very difficult time, especially that year, because Saddam was putting a lot of pressure on the Kurds.
But you met him as a young girl.
Oh, yes. Yes. Family connections we had. But I just fell in love with him because he was somebody who... very much have principles, and his Kurdish case is his life.
It didn't hurt that he was dashing and good looking.
That helped.
Yes.
His name is Sarbast.
Yes.
And he is, as you said earlier, a Peshmergan, which was one of the groups fighting. But there were a number of different groups, and it's in the past. Didn't that really hurt the Kurdish cause that these groups could not agree on a unified strategy, unified leadership, even unified political ideology?
I think in the beginning, yes, they were having different opinions, and I think this is something which is good, as if they are heading towards democracy, each one has their own ideas, and they fought, but in the end of the day, I think now they agreed that
the PUK to be, and the KDP. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They just united, and that's what where is their strength is.
And a lot of people don't realize that the president of Iraq now, Talabani, started the PUK. He broke off. He was a member of the KDP, and he felt they weren't, for him, he said they weren't democratic enough, so he broke off. But since then, we've been really amazed at how they've come together to build Kurdistan today. And now then, Kurdistan is a place where people are going to vacation from Europe, which is a real shock.
So I'm really proud of
which is wonderful.
Well, it's one of the few stable parts of Iraq. On the other hand, it's the oil-rich part of Iraq, and that's one of the reasons that it's unlikely that, at least under current circumstances, that Kurdistan will wind up becoming an independent nation. Yeah,
it's difficult, and I don't think they're really pressing for that now. They just want to be able to be free to rule. They have a regional government that's being actually quite wise, and they are wanting the freedom to have their own language, to learn their history, to do the things they were never allowed to do without fear of death beforehand.
Yeah,
we'll take a little break and come back with Jean Sasson, who's the author of 7 books, 5 of which were international bestsellers, 2 of them Princess, A True Story of Life Behind the Veil on Saudi Arabia, and The Rape of Kuwait were New York Times bestsellers. Her latest, Love in a Torn Land, tells the story of Joanna al-Askari, who is also here. The book is published by Wiley. Stay with us. Jean Sasson's latest book, Love in a Torn Land, tells the story of Joanna al-Askari. The book is published by Wiley. So you married a freedom fighter, a Peshmergan, and this is during the Iran-Iraq War?
Yes, it was in 87.
So this is a very dangerous time anyway.
It was very dangerous.
What was the situation for Kurdish men during that war? Were they being recruited to fight?
Obviously, I mean, Kurdish fighters, they, Kurdish people are welcome to join the fight. And really, they wanted more people to join. But it was very difficult time because Saddam started his campaign of just getting rid of anything Kurdish, you know, including the villages and the people. And
at the same time that he was fighting Iran?
Yeah. In 87 started the Anfal operation, which is like a genocide, really. And they started with all these villages, killing people and getting them out of their villages and just send bulldozers and...
Well, the Kurdish men had been fighting in the war against Iran. Some had. Many would flee, go AWOL and go to the mountains because they said they couldn't bear to help Saddam Hussein, who was such a murderer of their own people. But then they eventually, toward the end, you know, as he started winding down with Iran, then he turned his full attention to the Kurds, whom he felt had been so disloyal.
Now, were you aware of U.S. policies at the time? Because the United States was supporting Saddam Hussein in that war, which he initiated, I guess because the enemy of my enemy, the United States, hated Iran a lot more than it hated Iraq at that time. Really looked the other way when his policies towards the Kurds were so destructive. Were Kurds looking to the United States or other countries to come to their aid?
We always cried for help from anybody to help us, really. And it's unfortunate because when you look at the crimes committed against not just the Kurds, the Iraqi people in general, you know, and all these massacres, all these genocides committed against the Iraqi people, including the Kurds, no one came for their aid. I mean... When we had this chemical attacks, you know, on our area, it's really, it was very hard to believe that thousands of people get killed and the world was just watching.
I was most impressed when Joanna was telling me her story, when she was saying when she was in Baghdad, Iran was the enemy. Mm-hmm. Then when she went to the mountains, suddenly Iran was their friend.
Yeah.
I think the only people that the Kurdish turned to really to help them was the Iranians at that time, because Joanna said she used to look and say, where's the world?
Yeah.
But the world didn't care.
No.
Well, right now, many people are saying that the ultimate winner of the war in Iraq is Iran.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The chemical attacks were in the fall of 1987 when Ali Hassan al-Majid, who came to be known as Chemical Ali,
yes.
Attacked Kurdistan through the use of chemical weapons. Was anybody prepared for that?
Very basic preparation, actually, because when I joined my husband in the mountains in our village, the Bergalo village, which is the radio broadcasting station for the opposition party. The only thing I saw is he hanged in our house two masks. That's all.
Some gas masks.
Gas masks. And
but you didn't think it was so serious. You never practiced.
No, I never practiced. I never. Mm-hmm. Yes, we used to get bombarded every single day, but we never thought that a chemical attack will be, you know, next.
You were pregnant at the time, weren't you?
Yeah, I didn't know until after I left the village on our way. Then I lost baby in the end of our trip over the mountains.
Was it because of the trip or because of the gas, because of the chemicals?
Maybe because of all these, you know, reasons.
Traumas, yeah. One after the other,
because we got bombarded with the chemical. We had to run, and then we went to another village, and, it wasn't good.
You got buried in rubble.
Yes, when I was in the bathroom. And then after that, we had to flee, crossing the highest mountains into Iran. It was really
on a mule.
Very exhausting. Very exhausting time. So I think that's all.
Yeah, it would have been a miracle had you not lost the baby.
Exactly.
But were you breathing in those chemicals?
I had, yes, because unfortunately for my mask, it didn't function properly. And by the time my husband found out what's wrong with it, I had really good amount of the gas inside my system. And
Temporarily blind for a few hours. Terrible
experience. It was
it killed people. Do you know why you survived? Just and strong, I guess.
Maybe. As like a lot of Kurds, they are very stubborn, and they want to live and see free Kurdistan. Maybe that's why.
Well, there are a number of people dying.
But yeah. I had.
You
yes,
did get the mask yes, eventually
yeah.
on.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was probably the reason she lived.
Yeah.
Jean, during your research, did you talk to other survivors of the chemical attacks?
Yes, I did. I spoke with various members, and of course I did a lot of research on it too, and looking around. And what was so tragic for me was the fact that so many children died, because in the so many of the villages, there were not fighters. Now, when they attacked Joanna, Sarbust, and the other people, those were fighters. These people knew what they were getting into. But when they attacked just the regular little village, where it's people with their families and the little children died, and so many of the mothers, I think the most horrific story for me was when a mother would say, I only had two arms and six children, and I had to choose who I would leave behind. I mean, imagine that. I can't imagine it.
I lost my favorite auntie in the chemical attack on Halabja town, where 5,000 people, innocent
people.
That was
88, March.
In March 88, they all get killed, gas, just because they were Kurds. And it was really horrible experience for me to go through the refugee camps in Iran to look for her, and to see all these people telling horrible stories about their experience, and finding out that my auntie actually died on her praying rag, on her back garden.
She was praying.
Now, why did you go to Iran over the mountains? Turkey lies directly north of Iraq. It was a lot closer.
We were in the...
There was a war going on with Iran?
We were nearer to Iran, our where we were. In our
village.
Mm-hmm. It was nearer to Iran, and that's where obviously we had support, some kind of support from the Iranian to let us get into Iran. And that's where we were told by the leadership, by the opposition leadership, just to cross into Iran or to be on the highest mountain there and set up the radio station for my husband's radio.
Yeah, they needed that radio station to warn people about what was happening.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you wound up in refugee camps?
Excuse me?
Were there were refugee camps that were set up in Iran?
Yes, after the March 88, where the Halabja attack, a lot of people, obviously thousands of people, just fled the area, and the nearest refugees in Iran. So they end up in refugee camps.
When were those people able to return to Iraq?
I think after that, Saddam had passed a lot of amnesties. You know, you can come back and we won't do anything to you. So,
and that was true in some case and not in the others.
Yes.
But you went to
England. For us, it was impossible because for normal, you know, like people who did not have anything to do with the... they did not have involvement with the opposition. Mm-hmm. They could go back easily.
But Sarbas was greatly hated. And he was the voice of the radio who had said so many horrible things about Saddam. So I think they felt really nervous about that. They felt they'd be killed.
And also we were told that the next stage for the radio station will be in Iran. Mm-hmm. And obviously we went there. And after a while, after all what happened in Iraq and to the Kurdish people, we were told really there is no near hope now for us to go back. So we end up in Iran.
It was a dark time for the Kurds.
It was very dark, and there was like no hope. You can't see any hope there. So we were refugees in Iran. It's not in Iraq. We were there. We could not be free in Iran as well because we were Kurds, and we know their policy against the Kurdish people. So we decided just to leave. We didn't have any other choice, so we left for England.
Joanna Alascari is telling her story, which Jean Sasson relates in her book Love in a Torn Land, published by Wiley. Did you speak English when you went to England?
I thought I spoke English when I get there, but with all these different accents, you know, like Scottish and Irish, and we had studied English in Iraq throughout our you know, schooling and university, but I had to take a year English class just to get used to the English sound and everything. But
Now, were you able to settle into England? Your husband's past was so tied to Kurdish nationalism.
We had no other choice but to wait and see what going to happen in Iraq. So we thought we will just go there. We never thought that we will stay for 18. Now it's nearly 18 years.
And you didn't feel any desire to return?
Oh, of course. But
isn't it safer now? At least in Kurdistan, it may not be safer in other parts of Iraq.
It is safer in Kurdistan, and one day I will be back. But when you have children, a lot of things change in your life, your priorities and everything. And at the moment, I have an 18 years old and 6 years old who are brought up in England. So
Sarbas goes back and forth.
Yes, he is. He comes and goes. And we
and
go.
Takes the children.
And we go. Yeah. We go every now and then to Kurdistan, and it's lovely to be back there.
Well, it's safe in Kurdistan. The rest of the country is in terrible turmoil, and I think most people agree now that there's a civil war going on. What is your feeling ultimately? Is this all for the better, or is it only for the better for Kurds?
Personally, I think it will get better for everybody, not just for the Kurds, because the Kurds, they suffered a lot. They suffered the worst in Iraq. And I think the only thing is the Kurds got united. And when you are united, you get strong. And we are going through a bad, dark period now, but at least we can see a dim light in the end of the tunnel. But with Saddam's regime, we would never have seen that light. So obviously, we are struggling, we are suffering, but the Iraqi people are strong. They went through a lot, and I'm sure they will pull out of this.
Did you think Saddam Hussein should have been executed?
Personally, you ask me, I am glad he was executed, because I'm a Kurd, I suffered one of the worst genocides in modern history, and I nearly lost my eyes in the chemical attack, or lost my life.
You definitely lost a child.
A child. I lost my auntie, and the only thing I am sorry is he was executed prematurely, because he should have had answered for all the other crimes committed against the Kurds, the Shia massacres, and even the Sunnis. They did not escape their cruelty.
Think of the Kuwaitis.
And the Kuwaitis, that's true.
Now, the Kuwait did get him into trouble, but when I think about some of the things that have happened in the world over the past 10 years or so, Rwanda, where 800,000 people or so were killed in a genocide, the continuing situation in Darfur, what happened in Iraq, I don't know if invading a country is always the best way, but I wonder why these things are just, why the world just looks the other way until the situation gets impossible.
I have asked myself that a million times, and I can't believe that we're still at that stage where every time it happens, we say never again. Next time, we will not let this happen. The next time it happens, we will do nothing. And I think unless there's some reason for big government to be interested, they will never do anything. And each case is important enough that the whole world should come together. And unless we come together, it's very difficult to do it on our own.
Well, we rely on the UN. In the case of the Turks, the case of the Kurds, they have Turks, they have Iran, which welcomed Kurds during this situation,
benefit,
but it has not always been kindly toward Kurds.
No, they are not.
Syria has...
Same.
So there are these other factors that when the UN has to vote, there are just too many countries who have their own reasons for voting against giving any kind of aid. I wonder about your family, Joanna. You said you lost an auntie, but what about the other members of your family, your mother and father, your brother?
Some of them are all, you know, all over the world, actually, but also my brother was in Baghdad. He was in Baghdad, and he just had to flee because there was some groups just threatened
to kill him. They
exited
his door and said, if you don't leave, you die. He's in Syria now.
He fled and left his wife and children in Baghdad because he couldn't take them with him, 4 children. And, they're all suffering, but we just had to hope.
Is it rougher for Kurds to live in Baghdad, which it's the big city, it's the capital city, but it's also one where they are a distinct minority?
At the moment, or
well, even when you were growing up, weren't they? Was there a Kurdish part of town?
No, we had Kurdish all over, but not that big community.
No, not in Baghdad. No. They stayed in the north.
They all stayed in the north, unless you have some reasons to be living in Baghdad.
Well, even your mother did not want to marry an Arab and move to Baghdad. She was very distraught about that, but she had no choice, unfortunately, as women so many times don't have a choice.
Yeah. Now, why did you wind up in England, of all countries?
Well, at the time, we...
Not that there's anything wrong with England.
No, it's it was, you know, when you are fleeing and you want to seek asylum somewhere, you don't have that choice to choose, really. It was either Sweden or Britain at the time.
They were the only two countries willing to give you asylum?
At the time, that's where the smuggler would get you to one of those places. So obviously... a no-no to Sweden, because simply I couldn't speak the language. And we were like more, we thought we spoke the English language and we could survive.
Obviously now you're quite open about your experiences. Is that because you talked to Jean for this book?
Oh, definitely, because I remember, I have to tell this, Jean.
Very quickly.
I had very, you know, like she would call me to check about anything, and she would call me 2 o'clock in the morning for me, asking me about the expression on the mule's face while I was riding it. You know, like
rider details.
So
now I know why she hung up on you. Jean Sasson has written Love in a Torn Land, Joanna of Kurdistan, the true story of a freedom fighter's escape from Iraqi vengeance, published by Wiley. My thanks to her and to Joanna Alaskari for being on our show today.
We thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
On tomorrow's show, baseball superstar Gary Sheffield on his career as a Brewer, Padre, Marlin, Dodger, Brave, Yankee, and now Tiger. Then G.I. Jesus, a new film about coming back after the Iraq War. Plus, living legend Agnes Pilgrim, the oldest living female member of the Rogue River Indians, and an update on the epidemic of horrific crimes against women and girls across the Mexican border. By the way, if you are moved by something that you hear on the show, you can email the interview to a friend or post a comment on our website at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neeshick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Paula Crossfield, Barbara Kahn, Stephen Phillips Horst, and Will Jones. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.